Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. Well, she did only talk to me for a few seconds, and she got most of those facts wrong. But we'll straighten those out, I think, as I tell this story. But she tried. She really, really tried being put on the spot. Thank you, Nancy, and the rest of the committee for asking me to come out here. Jeff, you've been a fantastic host. Thank you very, very much. And I'd also like to thank my friend Tim for traveling here with me. He's from my home group. We have the same sponsor. And a couple of months ago, we were in our home group meeting, and he sits right behind me, and he nudged me, and he said, "Hey, those things you go to on the weekend, what are they like? I've never been to one." And I said, "Oh, sometimes they're small, sometimes they're large. They're usually kind of fun." And I said, "Well, there's a small one happening next month in Minneapolis. You want to go?" And so I kind of fooled him into thinking this was a small one. Anyway, most important thing I can tell you about myself is that I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. I have a really bizarre relationship with alcohol. And my bizarre relationship with alcohol takes on a couple of forms. And the first part of my bizarre relationship with alcohol happens when I drink it. Really strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction, and they say the symptom of this allergic reaction is what they describe as the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that when I drink booze, it seems like the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. Happens with nothing else, only booze. An example of that is I have a glass of water here. And over the next hour or so that I'm talking with you, I might drink half it. I don't know. If my mouth gets dry, I might finish that glass of water. But after I finish that glass of water, I can absolutely guarantee you that I'm not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in my hotel room. I'm not going to do that. But if that's the only thing that made me alcoholic is this bizarre physical reaction that I get to alcohol, if that's the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism, wouldn't it? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, "Just Say No." I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, "Oh, no," and just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I have this other bizarre part of my relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking it. I seem to have this mind that will rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs, no matter what the pain, suffering, humiliation of a day, a week, a month ago for myself or anybody that may have still cared about me. My mind can still paint the picture that it's okay to take another drink. So what I have is I can't drink successfully because of this physical reaction that I lose control when I drink. So I can't drink successfully. But I cannot not drink successfully because of this thing they call the mental obsession. So I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. And I set this relationship up with alcohol right from the get-go when I first started drinking. And I started drinking a lot later than a lot of people in AA. I was 11. It is kind of late these days. A few months ago, I was at a meeting in West Los Angeles, and a 12-year-old was taking a one-year cake and had one hell of a story going on. It was... So anyway, we lived in Seattle, and a typical morning in seventh grade for me would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. Every school's got a Loser's Corner about 10 feet off the school property, where you sit there and smoke cigarettes and try to look cool. And we would also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That's a jar full of whatever you could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before. Now, that jar is very scary because nobody's been to bartending school yet. So... there's equal amounts of whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth, all in that jar. There's green things floating around in that jar. And you can imagine five or six of us, 11, 12-year-olds, choking that down and handing that around. And, of course, it was the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. And it was even before Ziploc bags had come along, when you just have a regular Glad bag, and as you'd roll it up, there'd be about nine people spit on it, and they're like, "Oh, man." And we'd pack all those seeds and stems and leaves into a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if we were really desperate that morning, it would be a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pinholes in it. Were you guys there? Now, it's at this point that many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous often interrupt themselves and they say something like this. I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story. Now, I understand and have great respect for what they're attempting to do. They are trying to protect singleness of purpose, as Mari had beautifully described, a vitally and important part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Should never be forgotten. But that aside, I still think it's a bizarre practice for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. We don't have time for this. See, I understand apologizing to police officers and judges and people that may still love us, but I don't know why we apologize to each other. In fact, the most bizarre example I've ever seen of that was a number of years ago. I was in a speaker meeting somewhere in Los Angeles, and the speaker that night was giving one of the most ugly, heinous, blow-by-blow drunkologues I've ever heard. And I got to tell you, when I'm in a speaker meeting and the drunkologue starts to get ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. And I think that night I was on the edge of my chair drooling, looking up at the speaker going, yeah, buddy, go, 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 go. And at one point in this really ugly story, this speaker said, you know, I had 4 DUIs. And the judge said, if I get one more DUI, I'm going to prison for sure. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, I'm on the freeway in a blackout. I hit a family of 4. They all wound up in the hospital, and I wound up in prison. In prison, I sodomized men. I was sodomizing. I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs, too. I was the only one that thought that was strange that night. It was like, So anyway, by the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I was a neighborhood drunk. I was a neighborhood drug dealer. I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. He was not chuckling. He didn't find anything funny about this at all. And by the time I was 14, it was no secret to my parents. My parents, really good, solid people in the community. And it was no secret to them. I'm withering away in front of their eyes. I mean, most days I'm locked in my bedroom door. In my bedroom, the door's locked. I'm listening to Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, getting all the necessary tools for living. And and my vocabulary at this point is, whoa. Wow. Right? So they saw me. They saw this. But they didn't understand what was happening with me. And they tried to help. See, but they blamed my problems on people, places, and things. They thought if we can get him away from that damn group of kids he's hanging out with, things get better. If we can get him out of that damn public school system, things get better. And they tried all of the above. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, places, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, places, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. So by the time I was 17, maybe 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle, and my parents decided that Seattle was the problem. If you can get them out of Seattle, things would get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and in that 3 years, I got approximately 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content is what was going on. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. They would send out a big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas, and as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year, another impressive year, I'm sure. The second paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We're very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft, and it was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We're very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. Yeah. Oh, it's about this same time that a really bad night happened. A drug dealer went really, really badly. I mean, it was just one of those really bad nights, and I joined the Navy. What I'm about to tell you should scare the living daylights out of you, but on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test, and this test qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should scare the living daylights out of you, that the United States Navy would even think maybe, possibly, or even remotely about putting somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that test. It's called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. Couldn't pass that. And through a series of events, I was kept in anyway. They took away this nuclear status, and they kept me in anyway. And a year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. And it's, you know how that goes. I mean, this is the reason behind this, the fact that I would have an area of stripes where stripes used to be. It'd just be faded, and then there'd be something, and, you know. And here's the reason. I would be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and I'd look around at my surroundings, and I'd go, well, I'm on a big gray ship. In the middle of the Pacific Ocean. By God, I'm in a uniform. There's no doubt about it. I'm in the United States Navy. However, that ship would pull into a port. I would leave that ship and take a drink. And I would totally forget that I'm in the Navy. And I would come back to where I had last seen the ship when the drunk was over. And I don't know whether my drunk is going to be 4 hours or 3 days at this point. I have no idea when I start. And it's a very strange feeling standing on a pier at 6 a.m. in a foreign country and you're going, you know, there was a destroyer here the other day. We happened to be back in port, and I'd been drinking all weekend. I'm driving my car back into the base. Early on a Monday morning, I had a bottle between my legs. I was just trying to get enough in me to get through half the day. You know that feeling, I'm sure. And there's a guard shack at the front of every Navy base where a Marine stands guard. And if you're going to bring your car onto the base, you have to slowly pull up, show him your military ID. He'll check the sticker on your car. If everything's okay, you can park on the base. This particular morning, I guess there was a depth perception problem going on. I guess it was on my part. But I just remember, you know, thinking about how I can get enough in me, and all of a sudden I look up, and the Marine had this very startled look on his face. His head was out of the guard shack, and he was like, and I was wondering what he was so startled about until I looked down and saw I was still going about 40 miles an hour. I tried to swerve. The car hit this median on the right-hand side and flipped over, and bam, right through that guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. And the Navy was very angry that morning. The Marine was all right. They were patching me up at the hospital, and they were reading new charges on me. That's nothing significant. I mean, new charges, that's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. But the most significant thing that the Navy did that morning is they prescribed antabuse for me. And they sent this prescription of antabuse back to the ship's doctor, and every morning before quarters, I would have to show up at sick bay, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning and baffling and powerful side of this disease called alcoholism, and that is that I had no alcohol in my system, and I was absolutely going insane. I was suffering from a mental obsession and spiritual malady so severe that no amount of discipline from the military, no amount of information I was getting from the Navy psychologists they were sending me to every couple of weeks, and no amount of love from anybody that may have still cared was going to overcome what I was facing. And I didn't know what I was facing. I was facing untreated alcoholism with a thing called antabuse in my system that supposedly is supposed to get you to not drink. But I remember counting those first 10 days on that antabuse just... been 4 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes, and I'm on antabuse. And I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. Only with love and tolerance in Minnesota, I'm sure. On the 10th day, I just snapped, and I went AWOL from my ship. I locked myself in a little hotel room in downtown San Diego, Plaza Hotel, 4th and Broadway, a wonderful place to visit if you're ever in San Diego. Back in 1980, I guess this would be 86, it was $13 a night. I checked lately, I think it's $14.95 a night now. And I was in this little hotel room, and I got a bottle of vodka and a shot glass, and I remember as I was sitting there looking at the bottle of vodka and the shot glass on this rickety little end table in the room, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of Anabuse. What they had told me is, son, you need to understand that if you drink on this Anabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction you might get is you will get violently ill. The other reaction you might get is you might die. I remember looking at the bottle of vodka and I thought, well, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get. I took one shot and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure. And I took another shot. All of a sudden I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat. And all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. This is a very sick group if you think this is funny. In fact, I have proof of how sick you are. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years briefly here. 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. We'll get back to that in a little bit. But my first sponsor, Bob W., and his sponsor, real sticklers about the amend step. And one of the amends that I could not make while I was still in the Navy was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree. I did not have one. I either had to pay them back for it or go get what they had paid for in the first place. I know that's bad news for some of you 20-somethings. But after I got out of the Navy, that's how I wound up in the town of Covina. That's where the school I was going to go to was. And I took this telecommunications business bachelor's program. And in the first couple of semesters, I had to take this business presentation course. It's really just a business speech class, really. And in the first couple of days of this speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at students, throwing them up in front of the room, giving them a topic to talk on, and you were supposed to talk for 2 to 3 minutes. The instructor was just doing that to see what he had to work with for the semester. And after about 6 or 7 students were thrown up there, he pointed at me. And I walked up to the front of the room, and from the back of the room, the instructor shouted out, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So I told him about drinking on top of Anabuse. They did not respond the way you guys responded. They were like... There were, though, a couple of guys in the back going, right on, dude. All right. So, back in the hotel room. I'm red-faced. I'm hyperventilating. I'm sweating. And I took another shot. And up it came. My second and late sponsor, Eddie C., calls this next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. Just straight up and out. Thank God the Plaza Hotel room I was in, the Plaza Hotel is a type of hotel room where the toilet's in the same room as the bed. But I found the magic of drinking on top of Anabuse that if I kept drinking and kept puking and kept drinking and kept puking for about an hour, hour and a half, enough of the antabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm all right with that. I can deal with that. So if there is anybody that is on antabuse, I do want you to know you can drink on top of antabuse. But, and hear this, you do have to get two things going on at the very same time in order to accomplish this. The first thing you got to do is you got to hang in there. I mean, you really got to hang in there. And at the very same time, don't die. Now, if you can get those two things going on, have at it. Have at it. Yeah. So, I drank on top of antabuse for the last 7 months of my drinking. The only words are desperation drinking. There's no other words to describe that. My second to my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in National City. It's a very bad part of town. All I remember is fists were flying, and mine weren't. And that's the last thing I remember. And then I came to, and you know how when you come to, you start looking around for evidence of, are you in a lot of trouble? Are things all right? Do you recognize where you are? And I came to, and one of the worst pieces of evidence of a bad night were there. I came to, and there were men and women with surgical masks and tools in their hands. That is evidence of a very bad night. They had to do reconstructive surgery on my face twice. My last night of drinking, I'm being let out of the San Diego jail, being transferred from civilian authorities to military authorities. I'm in handcuffs. I'm being taken back to my ship. It's early in the morning. And that particular morning, the officer of the deck did not allow us on the ship. He put his hand up and said, no. Orders have already been processed on this loser, and the orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, I was standing there in handcuffs, lots of official-type people standing around me, and apparently some sort of offer was thrown out on the table. And I do not remember thinking, oh, thank God. Thank God they're offering this treatment thing. I am just at the end of my rope. I don't remember thinking or feeling that. Nor do I remember thinking or feeling what would have been more likely on that particular day. I don't remember thinking or feeling, hey, if I just act like I want that treatment thing, maybe I can beat this rap too. That would have been a more likely thing. But I don't remember thinking or feeling that. I now know that it just would not have mattered what I was thinking or feeling because I was in handcuffs. I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience in handcuffs was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs never once did they ever turn to me and say, so what's your opinion on this matter? It just doesn't go that way in handcuffs. So the decision was made for me, and I was taken up to a treatment center up in the north end of San Diego, and when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they were willing to take the handcuffs off me. That is who Carl Morris is without Alcoholics Anonymous. That is what society thinks of Carl Morris without Alcoholics Anonymous, that society is willing to take the handcuffs off me when the doors are locked behind me. And that is who arrived here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm in this treatment center. I don't know anything about what treatment is, or I don't know anything about AA or anything. I just know that I'm in this place. And everybody that showed up over the next couple of days, we're all going to do this 45-day thing together, and people showed up from various ships, bases, and commands, and our paperwork was going to follow us. Nobody had their paperwork with them because, you know, nobody had really expected to be thrown in this place. And so they've got us, they're doing administrative paperwork with us when our paperwork would arrive a few days later. And in the first few days, they've got this facilitator, and they're trying to get us, 35 of us, and they've got us in this group therapy room, and they're trying to get us to talk, and nobody's talking, myself included, just arms folded, looking at the floor, and nobody's talking. This facilitator, as this went on, got more and more frustrated with us. And on about the second or third day, this fellow named Paco, who's from some other base somewhere, raised his hand to talk. And this facilitator got a little excited, said, yes, what would you like to say, Paco? And he said, I hear I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to do this staying sober thing, and I would like you guys to know that Paco's not my real name. Paco's just a name I've always used when I get into trouble, and the other day, this looked like trouble. So, but my real name is Randy. And you'll find that out in a couple of days when my paperwork gets here. But I thought I'd be honest with you. And will you guys call me Randy from now on? And the rest, you know, we just kind of look up from the floor and say, yeah, great, nice to meet you, Randy. and looked back down at the floor. But this facilitator got really excited and said, "Oh my God, this is the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs." Later that afternoon, Randy was paraded in front of us. They slapped a gold name tag on him. They said, "Randy." And then we were all informed that whenever staff was not around, Randy's in charge. And he loved his job. He loved his job. On the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Lisa was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd never been to a meeting before. I had no prior opinion as to what Alcoholics Anonymous was or was not. All I know is that in the afternoon, we'd been in this place 7 days, and they said over the one MC, that's like an intercom speaker system through the barracks, they said, "Civilian clothes, parking lot, 6 p.m. So we're out there in civilian clothes, and five white vans pulled up, and we were off a clipboard. Somebody read which van we're supposed to go into, and five or six of us in each van, and boom, out into town each van went, and each van went to a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, of course, the van I was in showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we sat in the back. And I do not remember much, but I do remember this. As you guys started your meeting, a bunch of people got up to the front and all talked. Some, the first few read, and then the rest of them just sort of shared off the cuff for a few minutes. So it must have been a podium participation meeting. I didn't know there were different types of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. All I know is a bunch of people got up there, the first few read, and the rest just sort of talked for a few minutes off the cuff. But as I sat there and listened to what you guys read and what they talked about for a couple of minutes, I got this overwhelming feeling of, oh my God, they know. Oh, they know. God, they know. Now, if you would have seen me there thinking and you nudged me and said, "Hey, so what is it that they know that you think you know?" I would have said, "Well, I don't know. But I know that they know." And what it was is that I believe I was hearing what Alcoholics Anonymous wants any new person to hear in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was identifying with the way you described your drinking, and even more importantly, I was identifying with the way you described how you felt when you weren't drinking. You guys were describing the mental obsession, the spiritual malady, and that's the thing that had been baffling me my whole life, the way that I felt when I was not drinking. All through my life, when any authority-type figure would be angry at my drinking and I'd be standing there, if I could have verbalized it, I would have said something like this. Yes, I know it looks bad. Yes, I see that burning car over there. I know it looks bad. But if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't ask me why I drink. And you guys were describing that. I also remember this one other fellow who got called on and went to the front, and he, in the 20 years that I have been here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never heard the alcoholic mind described better than I did that night at my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy got called on, he walked all the way to the front, he introduced himself, and he said one sentence, and he sat down. He said, "My name's Jack, I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation." And he sat down. And I just went. The next night, we went to another meeting. And as much as I identified at the first meeting, I got really confused at the second meeting, because everybody at this meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. People were up there saying, "Well, my drug of choice is." And somebody else said, "Well, my drug of choice is." And the more they said that, the more confused I got. I was sitting there in the back thinking, was I supposed to be choosing out there? What on earth do they mean by that? So back at the treatment center the next morning, I decided to ask the counselor who'd been assigned to us, and I go, "Mary, last night in the meeting, they were talking about something called a drug of choice. What on earth do they mean by that?" And she said, "Carl, let's play a game." Now, that worried me, because now she wanted me to focus, and I had been having trouble with that over the last few days because they still had me on anticonvulsant medications. If you've ever been on those, you know what I'm talking about. Your field of vision is just fine about like this, but there's dancing squiggly things over here. And when you see me, look over here, and now they're over here. And so you're like, kind of hard to focus. So if you're ever at a meeting and somebody that's new that raised their hand and they still got the hospital bracelet on and they're kind of going like this, now you know what might be going on. But anyway, she says, "Let's play a game. Imagine this, Carl. Imagine I walked into this room and I had a tray. And on that tray I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take?" I started to drool immediately. Just, "Oh, I'd take them all. And she starts to snap her fingers. Settle down, Carl. Play the game. I said, what? She said, you can't have them all. You can only have one. Which one would you take? And I thought for a second, and I said, well, if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, well, then maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? And I said, no. No. She said, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I take that ounce of cocaine, I get the hell out of this place, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. Now I'd have enough money for a quarter pound of Tysix and a case of Jack Daniels. That's what I would do. Now, the only reason I bring that up is to bring up a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is sobriety days. If you are new or fairly new and you're going back and forth as to whether you're more of an addict or more of an alcoholic and all of this type of stuff, which lots of people these days go through, first thing I want you to do is stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and talk to enough informed people to find out what alcoholism is and to make a solid decision about whether you're alcoholic or not. But in the meantime, there's only one sobriety day. I'm sure there's lots of people in here that work with lots of new people, and I bet you run across this scenario like I do every once in a while in my home group. See some guy at my home group that I've seen for a while and go up to him and say, hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And every once in a while I get this. Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long. Like, no, there's one sobriety date. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety dates is the same scenario. I saw this guy around my home group for a while and went up to him and said, hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And he said, well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I had to think about that one for a second myself. I think that's kind of in the same category as being down in Mexico looking at the tequila going, would that affect my U.S. sobriety date? Yes. Yes, sobriety dates are also international. They are international. So anyway, after 45 days, they're going to let us all out of this place. That's what the orders were. And they're going to let us out on a Friday. And on the Wednesday before that Friday, they gathered all 35 of us that were going to be let out on that Friday. And they put us in this room, and the biggest, meanest counselor in the place, a Marine. And this particular day, he was in his full dress uniform. And he came in through a side door and marched in and just stood at this podium and just stared at us. Didn't say a word. And we all just went, huh? And he just panned the room and stared at us for a good 10 minutes. I stared each one of us down, and then after what seemed like forever, he finally spoke. He said, you 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction, and over the years, this treatment center has shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? Then he said, many of you will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and then make it back into long-term sobriety. But according to our statistics of this treatment center, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. And if you thought it was quiet before he said that, you could hear a pin drop in that room now. The only thing you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it wasn't going to be me. We all knew it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. He's like the poster boy of the treatment center by now. So on this Friday afternoon, they let us all out, and this is what the orders were. And people were picked up and taken back to their ships, bases, and commands in various different ways. But there was about 4 or 5 of us that had been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown in there. So we had to wait on the front doorsteps of the treatment center for our cars to be brought out of an impound lot, which took another 45 minutes or an hour. And I'm standing there with about 3 or 4 other guys, and we're kind of looking at each other. You feel treated? I don't know. You feel treated? And all of a sudden, one of the guys that's standing with me points at the other edge of the parking lot. There's a car slowly coming towards us. And he points at it and goes, is that Randy in that car? We look a little bit closer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure enough. One of the other guys says, he's drinking already. Sure enough, he's got himself half a pint. He's polishing it down. He rolls right in front of the treatment center, rolls the window down, throws the empty right at our feet. Crash! We look up. He gives us all the finger and drives right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing that I remember that day is I showed up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the North Shore Alano Club in Pacific Beach, north end of San Diego. And I'm sitting in the back of this meeting, and the truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink. I've got a lot of information, and I'm physically in the best shape I've been in since I've been a young teenager. But there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I had 45 days, information, and physically feeling better. If there was ever a turning point in my life, it was sitting right there at that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sitting in the back. And one guy that night operated in his primary purpose. I'm sure there was a lot of other people that were operating on their primary purpose that night, but this guy was the one that was lurking around the back of the meeting. And he nudged me and he said, "Hey, never seen you before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, because I promise you, if I would have thought for one more second, I would have lied to him. But I said, "You got me, buddy. I just got out of a Navy treatment center 3 hours ago. I don't know what I'm doing." This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face, and I'm like, "What is he so excited about?" I didn't know there's guys in AA that lurk around meetings looking for new guys that accidentally admit they don't know what they're doing. And at the break, this guy is like fighting his friends off. "He's mine, he's mine, I got him. But there was something else going on in this guy's life that particular night that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. So he's wondering what to do with his weekend: homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman. Just in between the meetings, he'd throw me in the passenger side of his car, and he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He just had an AA radar car that made it to the next meeting, I guess. And he'd be yelling at me, "You got to go to meetings, got to read the book, you got to get a sponsor. Damn her! Got to go to meetings, got to read the book." Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so glad that that guy that night was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I am so glad that that guy that night in his pain was not at home underneath his covers whining into his sponsor's answer machine, "She left, call me, where are you?" Right, looking for some magical answer from a sponsor. Right? He understood that I was the solution to him. All I was a prop in his weekend so he didn't do something stupid. He had no idea whether I would stay or not. So therefore, I think the way I've heard it put, and I totally agree, he was dragging me around that weekend not because I was alcoholic, because he was alcoholic. Right? And I learned something. And sometimes we misinform our newer people in Alcoholics Anonymous. We say, when you get into pain, call your sponsor. Now, yes, we definitely want to check in with our sponsor, but that's not where the solution is going to be, right? All we have to do is look at our history. And Bill Wilson, 6 months without a drink, pacing the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, business failure one more time, thinking of drinking. He did not get on the phone in New York and go, "Abby, this is just terrible. Please come to Akron and save me." Didn't do that. If he'd done that, we wouldn't be sitting here. He understood that his solution was elsewhere. He needed to find somebody to talk to that didn't understand the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where his solution was going to be. Right? So if you are new or fairly new, absolutely, when you hit those certain low spots ahead, check in with your sponsor. But go find somebody newer than you and drag them around until they can't see straight. That's what the deal is. I learned something by him dragging me around to so many meetings in the same area of town. I learned something really valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new. I saw other people that were going to multiple meetings over that weekend. Now, I didn't see anybody else doing 18 meetings, just me and that guy, right? But I saw other people that were at two or three meetings over that weekend. And what I learned about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only: to win the game. And how do they win that game? They huddle up, they make a plan, and they do one play. Then they huddle up again, make another plan, and they do one play. Well, that's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the game around here is one day without a drink, you are a big winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up. We go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of this and we try a little of that. And we run right back in here and we huddle up. And we go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. And just before we break, some guy in the corner might go, wait. Hang on, I've been here for 6 months. I'm sober, but I'm broke and I'm bored. What do I do? Some old timer will get up and say, get a job. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of this, try a little of that. After that weekend, I got back to my ship, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. He became my first sponsor even before I asked him to sponsor me. He's that kind of person in Alcoholics Anonymous. He just started doing the things that a sponsor would do, getting all on my case and dragging me around to meetings and introducing me to people. And you see, the thing is, he was living an extremely valuable way of life. I'm so glad that the one other sober person on my ship was not a person who hadn't been to a meeting in 2 years or 11 months and didn't know what to do with me. You see, he was living a way of life that was just so very valuable, because he was living a way of life that all it took was for him to stick his hand out and say, come on and do what I'm doing, to effectively save my life. Right? It's an extremely valuable way of life, and we often forget that. You know, at 2 years, 10 years, 20, 30 years, sometimes we get that feeling, is this all there is? And we forget what a valuable way of life we lead. And Bob started doing that, taking me around to meetings and introducing me to people. And immediately I had a huge, huge cast of friends and people I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was going to meeting, coffee, coffee, go to a dance. Ah, I can't do that. Meetings, coffee. And for many months, I did that. And I was actually depending on you to throw band-aids on my untreated alcoholism, because I was effectively avoiding the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and wasn't, I can't really tell you why, but I just was, and here are the symptoms that I was having. In the middle of the night, I'd been to two, three meetings that day, but in the middle of the night, I would be holding my gut going, oh God, it's back, what's the matter with me? What is the matter with me? That sickness 1 inch behind my belly and it's just hurting. And I get that feeling that I don't know which way to turn or where to go or how I'm going to make it in this world. And now I'm really confused because I think I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would run back to the very next meeting that I could possibly get at. And if you said something clever, funny, or insightful, I would get that feeling of, oh. And I would take a deep breath and I would have that feeling of I can finally breathe again, but I didn't know I was short of breath. I was depending on you to do that. That was the symptom of my untreated alcoholism. And Bob saw that, and he kept hounding me. When I was about 6.5, 7 months sober, our ship had to go out for a significant time out at sea. And he told me I had to meet him in the aft end of the ship in this little battery shop way down in the engine room, and we would meet there every night at 6:30. And he showed up with that blue book, and he showed up and he tossed it down on the table, and he said, come on, I've been hounding you about it. Have you read it? And I said something foolish like, well, yeah, sure, there's like how it works, we antagonists, some doctor with some opinion about something. And in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, this man opened up the book, and it was basically out of ignorance. Bob W. only had 14 more months than I did. And it was because he was not good at working or hadn't developed his own method of working with somebody, he gave me Alcoholics Anonymous in the purest form. He opened up and started to read. And when he was tired, I would read. And when the book actually asked us to do something, we did it together. Right? And he tricked me into working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Literally tricked me. And I am so glad that step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. I'm glad it doesn't say you become an expert first and then you are qualified to do that, right? He just was trying his best, and probably, I don't remember exactly, but, you know, as we opened up the book and started to go through, and, you know, when they describe the certain American businessman, and you know, they're trying to describe Ebbie Thatcher and Roland Hazard little bit of history in Alcoholics Anonymous in the first couple of chapters, he probably gave me some bad information. I bet you he did. Who cares? He was trying. He was trying, right? And he tricked me into working the steps, and my first time through there, I had what is described in the back of the book as a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I did not get the necessary spiritual awakening or spiritual experience or the healing at the level of my soul that I like to describe in order to find long-term sobriety when I took the steps. I did not get that. I did not get the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous until when I first worked the steps myself. I did not get on that path until I ever so feebly tried to do for somebody else what he had done for me. That's when I started to get that in the middle of the night where it wasn't coming. Or one of the greatest gifts of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous really was that when that feeling would come in the night, I might be holding my gut, but I wouldn't be saying, "What's wrong with me?" I would be saying, "Oh, there's alcoholism." Ooh. And that is such a gift. That's one of the greatest gifts of the steps, is you finding out what's wrong with you and being able to identify it. Instead of being ignorant to a wash of negative feelings that can come in and out of you, right? And so that's one of the greatest things. For the last 20 years, I've never said, "What's wrong with me?" The other thing that I learned is I have a responsibility. If I have found this solution, I'm reasonably armed with facts about myself. I have a responsibility to take my seat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because nobody but us can help us. Even the most qualified, well-educated, well-meaning people in our society cannot help us. It takes another alcoholic to carry that message. And I have a responsibility to take my seat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And how I learned that, I will never forget. Bob, my first sponsor, Bob W., and I would often, if we were in a foreign country, we would split a hotel room in order to get off the ship, right? And this particular time, we were in Victoria, British Columbia. And we got a hotel room, and then we went to the AA meetings. And after the first meeting, Bob said, "You know, hey, I'm just kind of tired. I'm not feeling well. I'm going to go back to the hotel room." I said, "Okay." And I stayed out with the AAers for a while. I got back to the hotel about an hour later, maybe an hour and a half. And on the way back to the hotel room, Bob had found this guy from our ship named Blair. And Blair was wasted. Blair didn't even know his name. He couldn't stand up. But Bob had him propped up against the headboard with an end table and a pillow. And Bob was reading the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous to him. Now, I thought this was ridiculous. Blair's not going to remember a darn thing of what's going on. But I threw my two cents worth, and Bob took Blair later back to the ship or maybe to another hotel room, I forget. But the next thing I knew about that situation is a couple of weeks later, and we're back in port in San Diego, and it's 3 a.m. And I'm in the berthing on the ship, and it's 3 a.m., and all of a sudden, bam, 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 bam. "Carl, wake up. What? And it's Bob. And he says, "Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. We're going to get him." Now, apparently over the last couple of weeks, Blair's tried to drink, tried not to drink, tried to drink, tried not to drink. I guess he's at the jumping off point. He's on the Coronado Bridge. And this is apparently what Blair... You see, I don't know if you know about the Coronado Bridge, but it's a very popular suicide spot. It's such a popular suicide spot that they actually have a suicide hotline phone up at the top just in case you change your mind. Right? And apparently Blair had gotten onto this suicide hotline phone, and this is what he was saying to the very qualified, well-meaning counselor on the other end. "I will only talk to Bob W." Now, the counselor was saying, "Who on earth is Bob W?" And Blair was saying, "It's anonymous." So they kept hammering away at him, found out he was from the Navy and what ship he's from. So they called down to the quarterdeck of our ship, just out of a fluke, trying to figure out who Bob W. was. And the guy on duty that night answers the phone, and they say, "Is there a Bob W. on that ship?" Now, Bob would protect your anonymity, but he did not protect his own at the level of that ship, so he could be of service at any time. So the guy on duty that night, out of the 300 people, he answered the phone and said, yeah, Mr. 12 Steps, we know all about him." So they go down and get Bob. Bob comes and gets me. "Carl, wake up. So we hop into Bob's car, and we start driving down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and Bob says, "Bone up on working with others, Carl. Grab the big book." And it's like, okay. It says, "See your man alone if possible, Bob. He's alone up there, isn't he?" Says, "Oh, forget it. We're going to wing it." And we get down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and everything that San Diego County has available for a situation like this is there. The fire department is there. The police department is there. The paramedics are there. The on-duty psychologist is there. And we walk up on this scene, and the fireman who is apparently in charge looks over at us and says, is one of you Bob W? Bob goes, yeah, that's me. He goes, I don't know what you're going to do, because we've been talking for an hour and a half, and he ain't budging, but here, hands him this telephone system that they had rigged up there, and Bob goes, Blair? And you can hear on the other end, Bob, is that you? Bob says, yes, Blair, it's me. Now get the hell down from that bridge. And you're,
okay.
See, one alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like no one else can. Don't forget that. We need to take our seat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. As I described earlier, 2 years sober, I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy, and a miracle of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, a very forgiving God in the Navy who forgot, apparently, a few things. It's a miracle of change of command is what. And I moved up to, that's when I was going to go to school, and I, through having to make amends, I was still, even though I got a Navy paycheck every month, I had to pay a lot out. I mean, most of it out. So I was still push starting the same car that I got sober in, a little 68 Volkswagen, hitting on two or three cylinders. I had to push start it, and there's a hole in the floorboard. And I'm puttering on up to Los Angeles with everything in my car that I own. Everything I owned is in my car, and I'm puttering on up, and I'm, you know, nice cars blazing by me and honking at me like I'm in the way. I'm, you know, I need a life. Man, I need a life. And I started thinking, you know, I really do. I need a life. And I've heard people talk about that in AA. I need a life. I'm going to be going to school. I'm going to work. I'll stop by some meetings when I get a chance. But boy, do I need a life. And I pulled into the what we call the 502 Club in Covina. It's our AA, local AA club in Covina. And to a noon meeting, and the man who became my next sponsor, Bob and I had decided, because he had to stay in the Navy for another 2 years, and our ship was going to Asia for a year on what they call a West Pacific tour, that I had to get another sponsor. And I went into this noon meeting, and the man making coffee that day walked up to me, and he said the exact same thing that guy said to me when I was fresh out of treatment. He said, hey, never seen you before. What's going on? This man's name was Eddie Cochran. He passed away in 1999, and he's truly one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a medallion there that said 1951, and he was making the coffee at the noon meeting. And I said to him, it's very nice to meet you. It's nice to see where the AA meetings are, but you know what? I'm going to be going to school. I got to work, and it's nice to see where the meetings are, and I'll stop by when I get a chance. But I got to get a life. I really need a life. And Eddie just chuckled the way that he always chuckled, which is this sort of, and he said, school and work, wonderful, wonderful, absolutely wonderful. But son, that's what we do in between meetings. What he was giving me is one of the greatest secrets of Alcoholics Anonymous and how to live comfortably sober. And that is that I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visit Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient. Right. He truly was giving it to me. One of the first things he told me I needed to do was put new guys in that car. And I said, sir, I have a hole in the floorboard. I have to push start this car. One of the new guys might fall through the floorboard. And he said, son, I promise you, you put new guys in your car, your life will get better. And I didn't see how, but boy, he was 10 years sober when I was born, so I thought I'd give it a try. And the very first night that I did that, I realized this man had not lied to me. After the meeting, I remember sitting in the driver's seat looking over my shoulder, and by God, my life had gotten better. The new guys could push start my car. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. And in between meetings, everything that I could have dreamed about has come to pass. That's really the way I've lived my life, is what I do in between meetings. And in between meetings, I've found a career that I absolutely love. I don't even feel like I work. But I have an office, and lots of stuff goes on a regular basis, and I just absolutely adore what I do for work. I remained single for 17 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and 4.5 years ago, a woman who I kind of knew from around town, not an AA, but she's a Covina woman, born and raised in Covina. And she had some friends that knew me, and I knew who she was, but I would never have asked her out. She's 10 years younger than me and really beautiful. And I was too scared that if I asked her out, I mean, she'd go giggle with her friends. You know, the old man asked me out. But she walked into my office and asked me out. And a year later, I put a ring on her finger. And by God, she was like pregnant overnight. It was just an amazing thing. But I was kind of like, yeah, ooh. And I'm in my mid-40s now. But at our wedding, standing to my right, as my best man, was Bob W., still 14 months ahead of me, because he's still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was appropriate that he be my best man, because I've been his best man twice. And looks like I'm going to be a third time here soon. Unimportant. What's important is still 14 months ahead of me. And on August 12th of 2004, our daughter Madison, this is where some of the facts were a little bit interchanged, our daughter Madison was born, and that was absolutely a life-changing experience, truly a life-changing experience. I have never known instinctual unconditional love. I've known unconditional love quite often, but it's unconditional love that I remind myself, oh, love is supposed to be unconditional, right? But boy, having kids, it was just an instinctual, unconditional love. And then, on January 21st, which was my 20th AA birthday this year, our son was born. So my life is dirty diapers, baby spit up, and a wonderful, wonderful life that I just did not even know was available to a guy like me. Didn't even know this was available. And it's because of you guys. It's because of you guys. Now, I love my children. I truly love my children. I would never, never in a million years would I trade them for the first drink. But I understand myself as an alcoholic. I would trade them for the second drink. And therefore, there is nothing that Alcoholics Anonymous can ask of me that is too much. Because that has to be the primary thing in my life, is I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's difficult sometimes when I leave to go do these things every once in a while. You know, when the suitcase comes out, my daughter, who is now talking and putting light sentences together, she looks at me as I come down the stairs with the suitcase and she goes, "Daddy, AA, bye-bye?" And I go, "Yes, honey. Yes, yes, Daddy, AA, bye-bye." And she goes, she sort of instinctually knows that I have to go. She goes, "Okay." But I leave like, oh, oh, oh. But you know what? This is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. It truly is. And the bottom line why I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous is really quite simple. If I were to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, from that second forward, the best thing that could possibly happen to me is I'd make it back. So why leave in the first place? Have a great weekend. God bless.